We will be talking about tiny houses in this hour, and not for the first time. Tiny houses are enjoying a little boom over the last few years as people look for ways to simplify their lives for either lifestyle or economic reasons. But today's guest is a pre-boom builder of little houses. Derek Deek Diedrichsen starts at small houses and expands from there in his book, Micro Shelters, Creative Cabins, Tiny Houses, Tree Houses, and Other Small Structures. Actually, 59 Creative Cabins, Tiny Houses, Tree Houses, and Other Small Structures. Derek Diedrichsen is a builder and designer. He runs the blog RelaxShacks.com and a companion YouTube channel, and has hosted or otherwise assisted TV shows on building small structures, both for HGTV and the DIY Network. Deek, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You give credit to your parents in the book. I mean, how early did this little building obsession begin?
Yeah, well, my father was a woodworking teacher through the middle school and high school, you know, through his career years, now retired. So I never took building classes, really, or courses, because I was a band geek and didn't have the free periods for it, but always had access to the tools. My mother was, you know, we grew up a frugal family, both school teachers at the time. My father worked summer jobs building decks, this and that. I was just always around construction, building, and both of them fixing things. So it's a very DIY-oriented family. So it's just, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as they say.
You always got the calluses on one hand from the hammer, right?
Yeah. I've gone to a bunch of, you know, different expo shows we do, and I get a couple carpenters coming to me. Let's see your hands. Are you really a builder? Like, oh, yeah, you are. You know, my hands look like Ben Grimm, the Thing from Marvel Comics, you know, after just building and salvage. Yeah.
I didn't realize there was such a test among carpenters. That's
interesting. Yeah, a couple times, because the people think, you know, they see the videos that I'm just hosting these videos, or someone's doing the building for me, or, you know, whatever. Like, or even on the HGTV show, too, in DIY. But no, I'm doing the building, and my hands prove it.
Not just a pretty boy on camera. Okay, good.
No, not even a pretty boy in any way, shape, or form, yeah. But thank you for being overly kind.
Sure. There's no picture on the back of your book, is there?
Yeah.
Right. So did it start with for you as a kid, did you build your own backyard forts and similar projects?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just doing a talk last night, because I've been doing this book tour and a speaking tour, and I'm going to be doing quite a few dates in Washington and Oregon, actually, next week and into the week after that. But I was talking about how originally when we were kids, what we used to do, and I'm kind of to this day, I'm doing an altered version of it, is we would find from a construction site, places like that, and with the permission of the construction, you know, workers, they would give us the stuff because they didn't want to have to pay for the dumpster weight, and let us, you know, just cart it off. And we would go and build illegally on the back acres of people's pieces of land, but we'd pick the swampiest and most mosquito-ridden places we could find. This way, none of the adults could ever come back and say, hey, get out of there, you kids. They couldn't find us.
Oh, so, right. They didn't want to come back there, sure.
Exactly, yeah. And we would find we'd traverse these slippery swamp logs and little swamp islands. You know, I always had this affinity for these swampy lands, just to get to these hard-to-reach places where we would then build and cobble together these, like, ramshackle forts and tree houses. And, you know, 25, 30 or more years later, I'm still kind of doing that, but with permission of the landowners.
That kind of echoes one of the cabins you went looking for. There's one way up in the woods, I think in Massachusetts.
Yeah. What's his name, the musician. That cabin there, the directions were pretty funny. It was like this treasure hunt, which was a lot of fun. You know, park at the third waterfall after so-and-so street, and then, you know, like all these weird directions with different landmarks in the woods. When you see the big oak tree with moss on the south side, take a left, head 300 feet, you know, it's all the smoke signals, and we found the place, and it was great. It was so hidden.
There are lots of some great pictures. I mean, the book is just lavishly illustrated. There's more picture space in real estate than an actual text. But that's right. Here's Jim Streamside Retreat.
Jim Matus. That's it.
Yeah. I just ran across it from Conway, Massachusetts.
Exactly. Yep.
So is the book pitched to the dweller or the builder, Deek?
Kind of both. I mean, it's, you know, I'm a total ADD case, I'll be the first to admit, so it's very eclectic, and that was my approach. I said to the publisher, and this was a new publisher for me, my old book was through the Lions Press, Humble Homes, Simple Shacks. I said to them, I want it to be wildly eclectic, very colorful, full color, you know, lots of photos, and a good amount of text, too. I also want there to be full plan sets in the back, and there is for about six or so cabins. But I want it to be not only like a inspirational photo book for dreamers, but something, you know, like you touched upon, I want it to be both for the dreamer and the builder. It touches upon decor, building in a budget, salvage, and it runs from tiny houses to kids' forts, like everything in between. It's just very eclectic. That was the whole goal.
If someone's never picked up a hammer, can they still navigate this book?
Oh, my God, yeah. And that's kind of, it's there's a lot of design inspiration with those who are who have done quite a bit of building, but also at the same time I try to gear it so that if you hadn't built before, you can go through that, and there's quite a few structures in there, even with the plan sets in the back, like, oh my God, I could build this. It's not rocket science or brain surgery or rocket surgery, for that matter. Combine the two, why not?
Sure. So, surgery aboard rockets, they'll need that in the future.
Yeah, maybe. So by all means, though, for the 101 builders out there and the established craftsmen and craftswomen, it's kind of geared towards both of them. Same with my workshops that I do. We get some master craftsmen, crafts folk, and people have never nailed two boards together, and we always try to acclimate and work both of them in, and that's what I tried with this book.
You know, I realize as I step back from what we're talking about here that we keep talking in terms of hammers and nails, but I didn't even ask about whether you're still a nail guy or whether you prefer to go with deck screws and screw guns.
I do both. I don't know. There's something satisfying about just hammering a nail. You know, the caveman in me, like, unga, smash, you know, like just hammering a nail. It's something fun about that. But screws work so well, and the beauty of them, you can back them out. They don't have quite the shear strength that nails have, but there's certain advantages and disadvantages to both.
Good question there then. So if you're using deck screws, you need to use more of them in the same application?
Or with tiny house and wheels, with some of the forces dealing with contending with on the highway, it's the screw and glue method where you use construction adhesive and screws, or better yet, ring shank nails, which can conveniently be fired from a gun, saving you time and your arm.
All right. Much more to talk about with Derek Diedrichsen. He's the author of Micro Shelters. We'll come back and talk more about all the great little structures he's had a chance to take a look at and make plans for. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Exchange with Deke and you in a minute 15. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Derek Diedrichsen, who's been building small buildings for a very long time. As you might have heard in our first segment, his father worked on decks in the summertime, so he was always around wood products and building. His book is called Micro Shelters, 59 Creative Cabins, Tiny Houses, Tree Houses, and Other Small Structures. Just a real plethora of stuff here in a whole bunch of different styles. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, talk about your own experiences, or ask some questions of Deke about the process and the plans. 800-838-3760 gets you on the air by phone. And if you'd like to make your comment or question by email, that's jx@jeffnet.org. So, Deke, just in summary, what are some of the strong points of little shelters?
Oh, there's quite a few of them. There's a page or two I devoted in the beginning. Some of them humorous, others more straightforward. But, you know, tiny spaces are, first of all, quicker and more affordable to build, easier to heat, maintain, cool. You know, your mother-in-law can't inadvertently come over and stay for weeks because there's just no space for her. That's one of the serious ones, not the comical ones. But no, my mother-in-law is a lovely person if she's listening as she sharpens her butcher knife. Aside from that, they're less site invasive. They can be, depending on how you build them. There's some over-the-top tiny houses these days, a little more environmental. One of the big things that I find from a lot of people, it's not even the environmental aspect of things, it's just I hate cleaning and vacuuming, and it's as simple as that. With a tiny house, you might have like a throw rug in the middle of the floor that you just bring outside and beat with a broom, and that's your cleaning. Or, you know, you vacuum up with a dust buster, and it takes you all of but 5 minutes or so. So that certainly is one of the advantages.
And do you live in one, or you use one for an office, I gather?
No, I live in I've built a ton of them for people and designed them. I live in a small house, about 800 square feet, five of us, you know, which is about a third of the American average, U.S. average, which is about 2,400 square feet. So it's funny, like, I consider it a pretty sizable house, but I have a lot of people, like, in my town who come over to visit, and I kind of once in a while get the, how do you guys do it in so small a house? I'm like, it's kind of a large house at 800 square feet, even with, you know, five of us in here. So, I don't know, it's very doable. And then you get a lot of people who are living singly in a tiny house, and you do the math, it's very doable. I know a bunch of families who are doing it as well.
I gather you do use one as your office. I mean, I can just imagine your property is probably dotted with little buildings.
Yeah, you know what? I jokingly call it the Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome-esque, like, Oompa Loompa village of redneck shacks in my backyard. At one point in time, I think I had nine of them. I only own a quarter of acre of land, too, in the suburbs. So they're like stacked one atop another. It's like a Lego land. No, but they're always they're in a state of flux. Like, I'll build one even for my own personal enjoyment, and then put pictures of it, and someone makes an offer on it. I'm like, all right, time to go. I'll use the money to build another one or shoot some videos. And I got like a recently remodeling. I picked up an old Tumbleweed tiny house company, one of their XS models off a friend who was selling it at such a price where I'm just like, I don't need it, but I'm going to buy it off you. I'll do something with it and remodel the whole thing. And I got a couple of tiny houses and wheels, some backyard offices and bunk houses and all stuff that I build for home and garden shows or for clients. And lately, it's been a lot of tree houses, and I'm doing a couple of them locally now.
All right, we have a couple of questions here, and I think one of them is about a tree house, so let's move there now. Here's Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Derek Deke Diedrichsen, the author of Micro Shelters.
Hiya.
Hey.
We have a 22-household housing cooperative in the Whitaker neighborhood in Eugene, and maybe 10 or 15 years ago, we built a tree house for the kids. We're actually renovating it now because the tree has grown so much. And a bunch of us adults play up in there as much as the kids do.
That's great.
And we also try to facilitate having lots of materials around for the children to make their own shelters. And
yeah.
I'm wondering a couple of things. Are you familiar with the adventure playground movement that was popular in the 30s and 40s, I think in Scandinavia and Germany? Where they adults facilitated children learning skills with tools.
Yeah, I am actually. I have a friend who's like very into that kind of stuff, and even establishing like guerrilla style playgrounds using recycled materials and bamboo and things like that. They which is kind of a spinoff from that, doing installations but letting the kids do the work.
Definitely.
Part and parcel. So I think that's a great thing
And I'm curious if you were in a position to be an advisor to governmental agencies dealing with homeless issues.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions on either changing codes or tax structures, or how can we facilitate helping people who need housing?
It's
to learn skills and maybe help build their own stuff.
Or to build their own. Okay. Yeah. Good point. All right. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough because I've actually, early on, if you look at some of my YouTube videos, I did a bunch of, like, prototype shelters for the homeless. And the idea with the videos was to, take this idea and run with it. Here's what I use for recycled materials. Stuff you could, in essence, find for free, from pallet wood to other things. You start running into, universal building codes. Like, that's not the established, tried-and-true way of building things. But on the other hand, it's like, to me, it's like it's that, or these people are sleeping in cardboard boxes. What makes it tougher is you'll find a lot of people who are, at least at face value, all for helping the homeless. But then you talk to them, it's like, oh, I'm all for sheltering the homeless, but not in my backyard. So you run into problems with zoning, people worrying it's going to devalue their neighborhoods if the homeless are nearby, the spillover from this and that. And it's tough. I mean, out in the Pacific Northwest, much more progressive area than some of the areas out here, I would say. And I see more and more gains with tiny house, like homeless villages, which I think is fantastic.
Right, Eugene particularly, has one.
Yeah, you're seeing it more and more. I want to say there's one in like Portland or Seattle where they're building these little tiny houses and wheels. I see little prototypes, these rolling shelters too, which I'm a fan of, but that's more just like temporary housing, get someone for, a couple nights or weeks out of the elements. I'm actually working on a structure right now that's lightweight, inexpensive, and kind of modern and cool and, aesthetically pleasing, that I'd like to push and do it a video to put it out there as a free idea. Like, what if you built these things for about $250 each using a good deal of recycled or new materials? So it's something I'm actually pretty passionate about and been working towards for quite some time.
So it does seem like we started hearing more about tiny houses right about the middle of the recession, but I gather the history goes a lot farther back than just that.
Oh, yeah. You hop in Pinterest, you're going to see some Model Ts and Model As that are, like, outfitted with, like, a house built on the back of them. So those are, like, the early tiny houses on wheels, if you will, and the old, like, gypsy wagons, Vardos, the circus caravans, the Canastoga wagons, the Oregon Trail.
Thank you.
You're heading out there. I'm from New England, so yeah, it's like
from Stoughton, Massachusetts, right?
Yeah. So hey, you got it right. Yeah. People are either like Stoughton or Stockton. Sadly, the town was named after the judge that presided over the Salem witch trials.
Like, I noticed that. Yeah.
What a terrible way to name your town. Well, I mean, great town, good people, but like, oh my God, you know what's next?
Right.
I won't. It's just awful.
Right. Well, okay, it's a long riff. We could go on there, but we'll stop at that point. So,
yeah.
just on the creativity in the tiny houses is amazing, and you only need to flip through the book for just a couple of seconds to realize, wow, people who do some amazing things with really small footprints. But really, how hard is it to cram amenities into such small spaces?
Downsizing certainly could be an important part of all of it. People who are younger have an advantage where they're at a station in life where they haven't accumulated all the heirlooms, the junk, and all the stuff from, you know, Aunt Rose or whoever who just keeps piling junk on you, or the parents even, you know. So they're at an advantage in that sense. But you have to have a certain kind of mindset or lifestyle or appreciation for the simpler things, I think, to make that work. And it's going to be even tougher when you start to pack a family into there. You're going to see a lot of houses I've seen designed where they put too much storage in there. People aren't yet willing to get rid of enough of their stuff to make it a viable option to live in a tiny house. And what happens is you start cramming in too much storage and little hideaway dressers and this and that, and you start gobbling up all your visual space in the house and all your physical space. And you walk in, and that house, while it has a billion little storage nooks, feels very claustrophobic. It's smaller than it should. And I've seen that with a lot of houses. People forget to, you know, put in some nice windows, bring in some light to trick the mind to thinking a space is bigger than it is, and just put too much storage in a space, or trying to live the old way in a big house in a tiny house, and it doesn't always work.
You know, I wonder about some just particular, not quite mechanical, but just, you know, quality of life issues, though. I mean, when I look, for example, at one of the ones that has the bed loft directly over the cooking area.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder just how greasy, for example, that could get up there.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a sealed loft. It's not like it's a sieve or grated. But, yeah, you're going to have, you know, hot air and smoke and whatever rising up to that loft. So a lot of people, like, are always worried, you know, what about heating and cooling these spaces? It's not so much being able to heat them. It's the condensation or overheating them in a lot of cases. So a lot of these tiny houses are super insulated. You're going to have active or passive venting, especially if you're cooking, a hood over your range, things like that. When people neglect to do that, you see that telltale grease spot on the ceiling, and of course some of that's going to make its way up to the loft. You're going to have those Cajun-smelling sheets, which you don't want.
It's a new style of sheet. We're talking Derek Deke Diedrichson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's been building tiny houses for a lot of years and giving workshops and going on TV to talk about it. His most recent book is called Micro Shelters, 59 Creative Cabins, Tiny Houses, Tree Houses, and Other Small Structures. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. And here is a call from Urban in Cresswell. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi. Just curious. I've been really intrigued with tiny homes for a whole bunch of time. Just curious the cost benefit between building a stick-built tiny home versus building one out of a shipping container.
Yeah, shipping container, the popularity of those is on the rise. I know near the Oregon-Seattle area, you're going to find quite a bit of them. Like, I was out there not that long ago, and they just seem to be everywhere. Even around us, I'm in Boston, so it's a port city as well. I'm seeing the price of those rise, but they're still pretty affordable. You can get, like, a 20-foot-long shipping container, you know, 8x8x20 approximately, for, like, $2,500, $3,000 maybe, in pretty decent condition. You're dealing with a lot of, like, insulative issues with those. You don't want those sweating. You're going to have to, you know, make sure you button them up a certain way. They're a little bit harder. You know, you're starting with a shell, but retrofitting and cutting into those is going to be a beast of a job for some people. But you have the advantage of starting with a dry structure, which you can kind of build from the inside out with a shipping container, while with a tiny house, it's kind of the other way around. But tiny houses are going to have that, might have that traditional curb appeal, which might be more accepting or accepted by your neighbors. Shipping containers, people, I think they're fantastic. I love the look of them. I think a lot of people still think they're kind of strange looking, these giant, like, Lego cubes that drop from space into someone's yard. But to me, the things are almost virtually bulletproof and so strong. Not so portable, though, in a weight ratio kind of way.
That's true, because they have to be heavy enough to not crush each other when they get stacked.
Yeah, they're a ballpark, I think, a 20-foot one's like, you know, I forget the exact amount, but it's around 5,000 pounds, give or take. And it's that's pretty heavy to start with. That's before you put any stick framing inside it, insulate it, you know, all your bells and whistles, cut some windows in, pop in skylights, all that stuff. So it's going to weigh probably twice that. There's a rhinocubed.com, and I just did a video and posted. My most recent one is based on their shipping container houses, and they look beautiful inside. So there's a lot that can be done with shipping container houses.
The tiny houses are very different one to the next. Like you showed the 227 with plywood walls, and it's followed by Mindy's shoebox with white walls. I mean, is there a particular formula at the base of it all? I mean, the stuff you really need to make sure you take into account before you start deciding things like wall coverings.
Yeah, I mean, basically it's the same thing with a house. You know, like insulation, keep the rain out. Central heating and cooling, or your plumbing systems, and basically around that, like as long as you make an insulated and dry and structurally sound house, you're going to be fine. It's a little bit different if you're building on wheels, because you have to then overbuild the house quite a bit, because you're contending with a lot of forces on the highway, headwinds, the wind you're creating by traveling. So you really have to overbuild the structures to prevent racking or them, you know, blowing apart in the highway and you making the headlines for causing a 40-car pileup.
Yikes. Well, you know, I meant to ask you about that before, too, when you talked about houses on wheels, about the different kind of construction for transportation. But do you find that some people will build a tiny house here and there on their own property and just want to have it on wheels just to move a few feet, for example?
Yeah, of course. Or it's the loophole in some areas where it's not a permanent structure because it's up on wheels. And in some areas, too, even a shipping container, back on that question from the caller, some areas shipping containers are still considered, because they're just a pod for transporting goods, considered temporary structures too. So some people will utilize that loophole as well.
Oh yeah, the wheels. I forgot that's how a lot of the coffee carts in our region started.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's you know, it's like a big like mail delivery pod pretty much. So it's not like considered, you know, traditionally they're shipped all around the world. So I think because of that, they're referenced as temporary structures. Even though you see them all the time in people's backyards, you know, full of like auto tires and junk and who knows what.
Derek Deek Diedrichson, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Micro Shelters. And I want to ask you about, you mentioned briefly about reuse and recycling. Expand on that a bit. I mean, how much can people build these structures out of things that have been just left over from another construction project?
Yeah, quite a bit. It depends. I mean, I'm a big fan of, and you can see some of the renegade builders, and then some of the people do everything by the book. And it depends on where you are and what the intent of the structure is. You're going to have to figure out which route you're going to go with that. I do a lot of building in Vermont, where I got a camp, and we got a crazy amount of structures and tree houses up there. That's a land where there's no building codes whatsoever.
Really?
They just want to know the square footage of what you build after so they can tax you on it. That's all that's important to them. But zoning-wise, you know, things, it's going to be, you know, I'm getting on a tangent here, but it's going to differ as to what's going to be allowed in your jurisdiction, your town, your county, and it's all going to be you know, kind of determined by town hall and you doing some legwork to find that out.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That was one of the other questions, was that if building codes are generally fairly accepting of these, but it just differs from place to place, it sounds like.
It does. Yeah. It's going to, and like I said, it's going to depend on the intent too. You might have someone who takes a shed and converts it into like a hobby space, you know, with an electric heater and they insulate it and this and that. That's different than living in there full time. Be nice to thy neighbor if you're going the illegal route, because there's tons of people. There was a book called In-Laws, Outlaws, and Granny Flats that came out, which featured a lot of Pacific Northwest homes. And they had a statistic saying they figure somewhere upwards of 10,000 illegal backyard dwellings exist in the U.S. that are just off the radar. And I have the foundation remnants of one in my backyard from apparently a guy who lived there in the 30s or 40s. So, it's a popular way to go, but you have to make sure in a complaint-based system with building codes that your neighbors are cool with it and you get along with them.
That is a key, right, the complaint-based system.
Yeah, like new neighbor moves in, buy them a bottle of wine. Tell them anytime you need to borrow ketchup or sugar, come on over.
Yeah, come on.
If you're going to go that route. I'm not encouraging that, but maybe someone behind me who looks exactly like me might be.
All right, you mentioned you live in New England, you build in New England a lot, which raises the question about insulation against hot and cold. I mean, how you're trying not to use up too much of your space with the insulation. Are you making some trade-offs there?
Not really. I mean, you're framing traditionally with these small structures so as not to gobble up the space, especially if you're on a trailer, because by Department of Transportation standards, it can't be more than 8'6" wide and 13'6" tall. So that really limits you in the space in your loft, and that's why these lofts are pretty tiny. That's including the trailer height, too. But with insulation, most of the walls are going to be 2x4, 2x4, you know, with your closed cell spray foam insulation or shredded blue jean and whatever, blown-in insulation, the Owens Corning stuff, all that. It's with such a small space. I mean, I joke you can, you know, heat these places up with a good fart or with a birthday cake. Overheating them or venting them after that Mexican meal is often the problem. So, you know, again, active and passive ventilation is going to be key, especially up in that loft. I see a lot of people building lofts that don't have windows that really open or open enough. And aside from egress, if there's a fire and you're stuck up there, you want some ventilation up in the hottest spot of your house as heat rises.
Oh, yeah, makes a lot of sense. All right, yeah. So insulation is one thing. Insulation against other people is another one. I mean, how do couples tend to do in tiny houses?
Yeah, I was talking about that with a friend recently, and I did an interview and we talked about that as well, too. And they didn't bring it up, but I said, that's pretty important. If you're going to try to do this with a family, as Junior or, you know, Missy or whoever, you know, gets older, you want your own private space. You know, they don't need to hear what might be going on in the adult pleasure lounge. So that's certainly something you got to think about. What some people have done, like the Morrisons, who are in the tiny house world, they built a separate tiny house for the kids, which, if you have the money and space, is a pretty smart solution.
All right. Well, much more to talk about tiny houses and other sorts of small structures. Micro Shelters is the name of the book. Derek Deke Diedrichsen is the author. We'll come back on the Jefferson Exchange and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Derek Deke Diedrichsen, builder, designer, TV host, you name it. He writes and blogs and researches and builds all kinds of small structures across the country. His latest book is called Micro Shelters, 59 Creative Cabins, Tiny Houses, Tree Houses, and Other Small Structures. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the work, which is well illustrated in this lavishly done-up book with photographs in color. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there, guys. It's a very interesting subject on many scores. I mean, I built stuff all my life, and I still do, and I still use, for the most part, materials that cost zero.
Oh, great.
Because I have to.
Yeah.
And so I'm familiar with all of this. The two subjects that sort of come up in my gut is, number one, the codes. The codes in places I know are all made by contractors, by people who intend to make money on building and who intend to make more money on restricting building that they can't control. That's point one. The second one is that a wonderful, lavishly illustrated book about tiny houses may end up on coffee tables of people who don't need to build shelter on zero or very little budget in a place that has all of these regulations. So, in a sense, how can we get tiny houses, which are normal, they are human-sized houses, but the way you live in it, we'll have five people, animal in part, on 800 square feet, and it feels good.
Yeah.
But how can we get these human-sized houses to people who need them and overcome the fat, looks nice, oh, how cute, you know, the little pet dog.
All right, so get it beyond the coffee table book and into practicality. Loud and clear. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. Deke?
Yeah, I think having the aesthetics, though, is part of convincing people or keeping the movement going. I mean, you know, what people, the naysayers, what they worry about is, well, if we do all this affordable housing, it's made with cheap junk, we're going to end up with these Hooverville shacks or Mexico City shanty towns. And that's what people fear, when the houses out there have proved quite the opposite. As for, you know, it being a lavish coffee table book, which I don't consider that lavish, but it's I'm just hoping that whoever comes across it, and it's in public libraries, are going to be soon everywhere where people can check it out for free as well. And, you know, while I don't make money off that, I still encourage you to check it out that way. I love the library. I go there all the time. It's still going to be accessible to other people. I do a ton of free talks all the time. So I'm, in addition to the book, I'm always trying to get the message out in free ways and other ways in YouTube to people as well. But he talks about codes in getting tiny houses more accepted. I believe he was saying universally for, you know, the more in need or the common man or woman. There are plenty of cases now, and you're seeing more and more because this movement is getting so large where it can't be ignored, where there are people who have built their tiny houses and they're fully legal. There's a guy in Massachusetts, Chris Haynes is his name. I have a video on it. He's got a house that's about 240-something square feet. It's off-grid and fully legal in his town. And he had to, you know, just work alongside the building inspectors, who are not evil people. They're doing their jobs just to ensure that it was done right, it was safe, there was egress, you know, the main breaker panel was in an accessible space instead of being hidden behind the refrigerator that's hidden behind some other closet in a tiny house, things like that. So there are a lot of people making headway in making this happen, making it legal, doing it affordably, and making the houses still look nice so that on a mass scale or level, they're going to be accepted instead of getting that stigma as being the made of junk, ugly shacks down in Mexico City. And I hear that one all the time, when in fact some of those places down there are pretty ingenious and not junky looking.
But it's a fairly common epithet, it sounds like.
Yeah, Hooverville shacks you hear and Mexico City shanties. That's what people worry about. That's all that they think. So that's why the houses have done so well, the ones you see, starting with, you know, Jay Schaefer, who founded Tumblebean Tiny House Company, now runs Four Lights Tiny Houses. And people like Dee Williams from Olympia, Washington, they have these beautiful houses that have curb appeal, and that has helped to propel the movement and show people that, you know, tiny houses can look great, look nice. They're not just cute, but they actually work, too, when you step inside and see some of these video tours and see cases where people have lived for years and years in tiny houses.
I gather, Deke, you haven't lost your capacity to be blown away because you're so impressed by some of the stuff you see. And you rave about the giant Journey home, for example, in the book.
Oh, yeah, that one's fantastic. I'm friends with them now, and they came over. I'm a Cub Scout den leader, too, and that was one of the coolest Cub Scout meetings ever, where they were staying in my driveway when they were traveling for about 10 days, and we did a Cub Scout, you know, tour of it, a Q&A session, and we packed like 16 Cub Scouts, Wolf Scouts, into a tiny house, and they still talk about it. But, yeah, I mean, so many people are into it. There's so many creative people out there, and, like, geez, I stumble across houses like every week that blow my mind. They're just so creative, or just if it's not the way they're built and the roof lines or the spatial layout, it's the interior decor, the color, or the recycled materials. There's so much by way of inspirational stuff, especially as compared to like 5 or 6 years ago. I was blog number 6 that had anything to do with tiny houses, relaxshacks.com.
Just to get the plug in there.
Yeah, there you go. Humble Home, Simple Shacks, original book, available now. No, but now I can't even count the amount of blogs and sites out there, and it's fantastic. I don't see them as competition. I see them as like, you know, heck yeah, this movement's really taken off, and you're seeing a lot of creative approaches.
A couple of questions here. Let's go to Charlie in Granada, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Deke, and we're talking about micro shelters.
Hey, yeah, this is cool to hear this on the radio. I mean, it's definitely been a movement that's building, so it's fun to hear the conversation go on the radio, but... I'm originally from Santa Cruz, and down there it's so expensive. You know, the tiny home thing was very much like kind of a loophole for me. And for a while there, I was looking for a piece of land where I could just kind of park some tiny homes on it and not have to get permits and not have to go through that whole route. And, you know, I figured, well, if they're all on trailers, then they're temporary. And even if the city does come, then I can just tow the things out of there. And, hey, what are you talking about? There's no houses here.
Yeah. The Houdini house. It's gone.
What's that?
No, I said the Houdini house. It's gone when it needs to be.
Exactly. So the main problem with that, though, is because I'm no stranger to the building department because I was a contractor down, or a carpenter down there.
Yeah.
And so I was calling the building department going, hey, you know, so I just asked them straight up, you know, this is my idea. This fall, you know, is this going to be in violation of any of your ordinances? And, what they said was, technically no, but what is restricting a lot of the properties in California mostly, I know, I'm not sure about Southern California, but Northern California, most of the counties don't allow you to camp on your property for more than 3 months at a time. So even if you were to build tiny homes and you got your house onto your property, technically, you would still be in violation if you didn't leave the property for an amount of time.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, some of that might come down to semantics. I know what with Jay Schaefer, who built his first house in 99, And I've had a lot of I'm friends with the guy. I've had a bunch of these, like, you know, conversations with him. Originally, he found out when he lived in Iowa, you couldn't camp on your land for more than a month. And he thought, he's like, I'm a guy who travels all the time anyway, and, you know, goes and stays with friends and all that. He's like, technically, if someone wants to sit there with a clipboard at night with binoculars and watch how many nights I sleep there, if they have the manpower to do so, you know, let them do that. But once a month, I can reset the clock by going somewhere with all my money saved and staying at a hotel or just travel. I mean, that might sound like a pain in the butt, but I guess, or, you know, it comes down to semantics in some of those loophole cases. I don't really know what the rules are in Northern or Southern California. Like I said, up in Oregon, they're making some headways. You're starting to see, like, I think Portland has the tiny house hotel right now. And while that's not full-time dwelling, those are small steps towards the acceptance, the slow acceptance of allowing tiny house communities. And there's quite a few of them being developed or being pushed towards in the U.S. right now. So I don't really have the answer to that, but because there really isn't a universal one or one even regionally available. But I think you have to go in and check out some of those communities and just talk to those people to see what they've been doing, because it seems like some of them are making progress, and you're going to start seeing more and more of that soon. Shared resources, you know, these little tiny house compounds.
You have a fair amount of familiarity with Oregon, it sounds like, and I wonder, Jeannie in Medford had asked a while ago if you'd heard about the Takilma Treehouse Resort.
Oh, yeah, I'm treehouse obsessed. There's plenty of them out there. And I'm doing my book tour. It starts, I fly out, next week, and I know Sunday the 11th I do Olympia. I do a Portland one at Powell's on Monday, October 12th. Corvallis, Oregon, Salem, Oregon, a bunch. This is all like the 13th, the 14th of this month. I've actually never been to Oregon before.
Really?
But there's just so much going on out there, and I have some friends out there that I talk to them all the time, or there's so many cool videos of tiny houses and Airbnb.com rentals out there that are tiny houses. It is a hotbed for micro-architecture activity, much like Asheville, North Carolina is on the East Coast.
So with treehouses in particular, and I know with it that Skeeter had asked about this before, a little bit about treehouses more generally, but how do you build in ways that don't warp the house or hurt the tree?
Yeah, there's quite a few methods. David Stiles is a old-school treehouse expert. The guy's like 80-something now. I was just talking to him about this because we all have our different approaches. Some of the simple ones are to simply pre-drill and slot the holes before you put your bolts in to allow the boards, the girders or supports that hold up your treehouse, to actually move with the trees to offer some forgiveness, because the tree is going to expand. It's going to move in storms. Like, we got a hurricane rolling through here soon. We got like 8 days of rain here. You know, you want to make sure that platform can move with the trees and not tear apart all the woodwork. Tree houses aren't forever if you're not maintaining them or tweaking them here and there, backing out some of the bolts. There's ones that are held and suspended by cables. There's a whole variety. I've seen just roped tree houses. I had one when I was a kid, which didn't hurt the tree at all. There's only certain kind of trees you're going to be able to build into. So that's part of that's knowing what diameter to work with, what kinds of trees, what's going to be supportive, strong, and how to attach to those certain trees.
A couple of questions about scale with some of the smaller stuff. And by the way, I'm looking at your Oregon appearance list. I found it at relaxshacks.com, but you only get as far south as Salem. Darn it, you don't get to Eugene.
Yeah, I was almost going to do one. Yeah, in Bend, Oregon, I had one at one point in time, but it ended up being too much of a stretch distance-wise for me to solo drive, mm-hmm. like 7 hours and back from one city and be somewhere the next night, which bums me out because tinyhouseblog.com, Kent Griswold, one of the biggest names in the game and a friend of mine, that's where he lives, in that general area. So I wanted to do that one, but next time.
Yeah, for sure, next time. All right, so on houses, on size, just in scale, question number one of two is, how does a big guy like yourself, you're 6'4", do in these spaces?
Yeah. No, I do fine, but I tell people, like, I've had people in my workshops. We had a guy from Texas 2 weekends ago, my Vermont workshop, Tiny House Summer Camp 3. He was 6'8", or 6'7", or 6'8". I tell them, just build the house to suit your needs, to acclimate you. You're going to sacrifice some loft space when you build a taller first floor, or you could do it in reverse, put the bedroom downstairs or a step-up style bedroom. And I tell people, like, this house is built for you. You're not going to be throwing big toga parties or entertaining tons of guests all that frequently in there, I would imagine. So build it to suit your needs. And if someone comes to visit and they're inconvenienced here and there for a day or two, Shaquille O'Neal wants to have a, you know, sleepover or something, let him be inconvenienced for a night. It's your darn house, you know, it's built to suit you. As long as it's not to the point where it's unsafe, like, you know, my first floor is 3.5 feet tall and I have to Crisco my body to slip and slide into the kitchen, that's not a good thing. That's, you know, you get hurt and that's just not safe fire code-wise.
The second question on scale was about the standard-sized doors and windows and whether you're looking for smaller stuff in a lot of cases for these kinds of houses.
Yeah, you are, and some people are even going so far as to custom order or custom build their own doors, because the problem is if you take a house, you know, some of the ones on wheels, it's 8'6" wide, and you pop in a 36-inch door, it's out of scale. It makes your house look so, like, door heavy, if you will. It looks ridiculous, I feel, and you'll see a lot of examples of that online. So people will scale down the doors. The problem, of course, becomes, you know, getting certain pieces of the furniture in and out, but that's just something you're going to have to pre-plan or contend with. We got a cabin in Vermont. We have, just as a joke, we have this monstrous armchair in this loft, like 26 feet in the air, this spire of a cabin. People always ask, how the heck did you get that in there? We built it in, then framed the rest of the wall. So just to mess with people.
So we talked about hammers and screws and screw guns and all that sort of stuff. And I do see you do put a list of tools you're going to need here. But if somebody's a bit of a klutz and they've never really done much carpentry work before, do you work them slowly enough in the gathering your tools section of the book so they can get the lay of a feel for what they're doing before they hurt themselves or mess up their tiny house?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about that. I don't dedicate, like, you know, a 20-page chapter to the art of using a hammer or anything like that, because as I say, there's a billion books on rudimentary tool use. Mine's more the design, the inspiration, and plan sets. But I also talk about, in addition to some of the, you know, the tools I feel you should have, some of the ones you might need for salvage to save money, and you know, some of the tools that are often overlooked that I feel are valuable.
There's a real wealth of stuff in the book. It's called Micro Shelters, 59 Creative Cabins, Tiny Houses, Tree Houses, and Other Small Structures. Derek Diedrichsen is its creator and our guest. Deke, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much, Jeff.
Take care.